We started talking about Rome last Wednesday night, and as far as the chapters in the book go, if you have a book or had a book or have seen a book at a distance or whatever the case may be, there are actually 14 chapters in the book. Normally we would have 13 chapters. 14 is extra. This is chapter 12, and we're going to rush more a little bit tonight, I hope, and we'll talk about things from chapters 12 and 13. Next week is our last class in this particular series, and I want to show a PowerPoint on Bible archaeology so we can see some of the evidences dug out of the ground that coincide with some of the things about which we've been talking, and certainly portions of the Bible that we read from time to time. We already made mention of Rome being important to us for a couple of reasons, one of which is it's the object of some Old Testament prophecies relative to the establishment of the church, and as we open up the New Testament, Rome was ruling the Mediterranean world. And then, of course, we have one of the epistles of the New Testament penned to the church of our Lord at Rome, so certainly Rome plays a significant part in our consideration of the Bible, our consideration of Christianity, from its beginning and forward. And so we next take a look at an overview of some of the information regarding that piece of land we call Italy, where is Rome. And I suppose most of you are sitting so far back that you can't see this up here, but you either have a book or you can look at this or simply listen, and either of which will be satisfactory for what we're doing tonight. You may recall on the map we brought in at the beginning that, and as well as other times that you've looked at a world map, that Italy is in the shape of a boot. We introduced it as being a cowboy boot, a pink cowboy boot on my map that we had at the beginning. It extends down into the Mediterranean Sea. It's 650 miles long and 125 miles wide. And there are a series of mountain chains in Italy running north-south that presented some challenges to the occupation of that piece of land. And because of the characteristics of the topography or the lay of the land affected the way in which that piece of land was settled and the way that it developed as far as its politics is concerned or developed as a nation. And so these mountains rise from 4,000 to 9,500 feet tall. Regarding the peninsula of Italy, beyond the peninsula it extends into the main part or body of Europe, another 70 miles and approximately 320 miles wide. I see that the notes say that approximately 91,200 square miles, and that doesn't really mean much to me. It probably doesn't mean much to you either. When we go down to Guyana, South America, the various things to which we can turn and read regarding the country tells us it's about 80,000 square miles. That still doesn't mean much to me. And then it says, well, it's about the size of the state of Iowa, and that means a little bit more to me, but not a whole lot more to me. But at any rate, we're talking about a relatively small piece of land compared to, for instance, the United States of America, or a small piece of land relative to the other countries that occupy the continent of Europe. So we have this piece of land, this piece of land extending down into the Mediterranean Sea. Nearly all the few deep water harbors are on the west side or the western shore of Italy. And then we have lowlands consisting of coastal areas between the sea and the mountains on either side of the country, but on the wider coast is on the west side. And so that was more desirous for immigration, for settling, for colonization, than, say, the mountains or between the mountains or a narrower coast on the eastern side. The climate differs quite a bit from one part of the country to another. I guess we could say that regarding this country, where it had 80-degree temperatures today. And I've been on the phone with others around the country, and some of them were very happy to have 50, and others didn't have that much heat where they were. So the temperatures vary quite a bit from location to location in our country as well. Same thing with regard to Italy. Italy's the Florida of Europe, I guess, as far as its relationship to the continent, as far as our relationship is to the rest of North America is concerned. And so we have definable seasons in the northern part of the country, and we have tropical temperatures down in the southern part of Italy. Mountain passes to the north encourage settlement from the main body of the continent of Europe, and then a wider coastal plain in southwestern bays invited immigrants from the sea from the west. And then there was a narrower eastern seaboard, and therefore it did not invite colonization or immigrants as readily as other parts of the country. The two mountain chains running north and south in the country discouraged cooperation to the extent that it inhibited a political union, divided various communities. They were already somewhat diverse as far as their origins, coming from different locations relative to the parts of Italy that they settled, the western seaboard, or coming from the continent down into the northern part of Italy. But the mountains helped make this a continual problem of getting together. And then in antiquity anyhow, irrespective of whether we have some type of a land mass that interferes with getting together with your neighbors, as we've been talking about over in Canaan land, as we would think about ancient Greece, every city was essentially a nation of its own. Every city had its a wall around it. It had its own army, not a police force, but an army. It had a king, not a mayor. And they had a political conflict with other cities, with their armies and so forth. And with the type of challenges of a topographical or mountains or something of that nature also in the mix, then the getting together as one people or getting together as a nation would be a slower process. So, such was the case regarding Italy. Nevertheless, Rome was founded in 753 BC, a long time ago, a long time before the first century AD. And it was founded by Romulus on one of seven hills. And then, of course, over time, the city would expand, and it expanded until it's over seven hills. It was built on the east bank of the Tiber River. And so the ancient city, as is the case with many of the ancient cities about which we would read historically in secular history or read about ancient cities regarding biblical narration, are not current. The newer cities have been built adjacent to the older cities in many instances. There are very few circumstances in which the ancient city is still occupied, or the ancient city is, or the current city is in the same place of the ancient city. Rome has two cities, as it were, the ancient city and the modern city is growing up adjacent to it. That some of you have probably been to Rome. I've not been to Rome, so you could probably be more forthcoming on that sort of thing, the relationship of the old city and more modern structures than I would be able to do. The information available to me says that the modern city lies north of the ancient city. Now, Rome was one of the most grand cities in the world. It, like a lot of other world empires of the time, it seemed to radiate out from a particular city. We have Babylon, the Babylonian kingdom, taking its name from its principal city, Babylon. We have, in this case, the Roman world, Italy. We have all radiating out from Rome. And so Rome was one of the magnificent cities of the old world. And there were a few reasons for which it became such a principal city in the world. It was a city described with magnificence and splendor. And they were able to do this through a number of ways, one of which was their conquest over the Mediterranean world, their subjection of foreign peoples or nations to them, or enable them to harvest treasures or things that were valuable, as well as skilled slaves, bring all of these back to Rome, and then the treasures, and then the skilled craftsmen being able to contribute to making Rome all that much of a greater place. But also, secondly, they had a determination to be the biggest and the best city in the world. And so we could have a lot of resources at our disposal for any circumstances or any project or any location. But if we don't have the get up and go, we don't have the initiative, we don't have the ambition, then all the resources will not avail being able to do anything significant with them. But sometimes what is, might be lacked in resources can be made up in the ambition and the initiative. In the case of Rome, they had both. They had the wealth, they had the skilled labor from their conquest. They also had the ambition and the initiative to try and be the biggest, best, most magnificent city on the planet. And they did a lot toward that end. The city was characterized by a number of different temples, huge assembly halls, open marketplaces, aqueducts to bring in water above ground from distant locations to provide adequate water for the populace of the city, public baths and theaters, palaces, triumphal arches, statues, and parks. Now, early on, the buildings were made out of brick. And then later, as the city became more prosperous, as the reaches of the Roman Empire went out further, they were able to harvest more resources from the peoples that they conquered, then the brick gave way to marble. One of the most useful contributions that the Roman Empire made with regard to the spread of Christianity, obviously it made unintentionally, but nevertheless it made it nevertheless. And that was that there were 31 major highways that all went to Rome. Each of the major world powers that were a part of the dream of Nebuchadnezzar over in Daniel made their contribution, albeit maybe unintentionally, toward just the right time for the gospel of Christ to expand all over the world. I made mention, I think, some of this a little bit earlier. We have the Babylonian kingdom, we have the Persian kingdom, we have the Greek kingdom, and we have the Roman kingdom or the Roman Empire. Among other things, the Persians developed a system comparable to the Pony Express of the early Western frontier in our country, whereby mail or documentation, literature could travel very rapidly from one point in the kingdom to another in a matter of hours or a matter of days. And then we have the Greeks providing us a universal language throughout the entire expanse of the known world or the Mediterranean world. We have the Roman Empire providing us these major highways. Also, because of their iron-fisted rule, they stopped piracy in the Mediterranean Sea. They provided law and order for the most part in the Roman Empire. And so an individual could travel relatively easily for the time period throughout the entire Roman Empire on the roads that were made because of the general law and order that was in place, also because of a universal language in the Roman Empire, that being Greek. And and then, of course, even sending correspondence was more easily done after we have the contribution made by the Persians. If in any generation of time we were left at our mercy to develop from scratch, from the beginning, with no help, no reference to any previous or prior civilization, we wouldn't be sitting in air-conditioned buildings, we wouldn't be using electric lights, we wouldn't be driving automobiles, we wouldn't be flying in airplanes, we wouldn't be doing any of the things for which we take a little thought and take for granted today. But the reason we can have the resources, or we can have the lights and the AC and the heat and the automobiles and space travel and air travel and all these things, is because of the accumulative knowledge that we pass on from one generation to another, using that as the foundation on which to build even more. The same thing is true with regard to the things put in place over hundreds, if not thousands, of years leading up to the time of the coming of the gospel and the spread of the gospel throughout the known world or the Mediterranean world. And so these 31 highways were very significant. These highways were built very substantially, and so that in some places in the old Roman Empire, these highways still exist. They may not be taking modern traffic on the surface of those old highways, but where those old highways can be discovered, the foundations are intact. They made them very substantially. And then we have also, of course, the emperors of Rome. We have Augustus became emperor. When he became emperor, he had 500,000 soldiers at his disposal. 300,000 of these he dismissed and sent to the be settled in the colonies. That is, those places or countries to which the Romans had already gone and conquered those people. So he had too many fighters, too many warriors. But there's a very, very smart thing that he did with regard to settling these people, giving them free land all the way around the Roman Empire. What do you suppose would be a good tactical reason for settling 300,000 soldiers throughout the conquered land? Any ideas? What do you think? Okay, they're going to be loyal to the Roman Empire. What kind of an influence and impact they're going to have on their neighbors all over the empire? If you had a policeman living in the house on your right hand side where you live, and you had an FBI agent on the left hand side, and across the street was CIA or whatever, you might take that into consideration before you did something out of the way and unlawful. And so these were soldiers that could be called up at a moment's notice and put down perhaps a rebellion, or maybe because of their very presence would dismiss in the minds of many the idea of rebelling against Rome. So we kept hundreds of thousands of soldiers in harness, as it were, armed, and we retired 300,000 of them throughout the colonies. Then the Romans, beginning with Augustus, relied primarily on a professional volunteer army. We think maybe that we thought of that in the United States of America, that we have a volunteer army. It didn't used to be volunteer. When I was growing up, we had the draft. But then again, after a while, we went to a volunteer armed services in our country. Well, the Romans had a volunteer army. I suppose there's some tactical advantages to that as well, as far as loyalty, commitment, and so forth are concerned. Now, these army units were divided in different categories. We had two main categories of army units, one of which were referred to as legionnaires, and the other of which were the auxiliaries. It doesn't take too much reflection for us to figure out some of the differences might be between the legionnaires and the auxiliaries. We have auxiliary policemen today. We have auxiliary this and that. When I was in the Air Force, I was an auxiliary security policeman. Didn't do very much of that job. My main job was in an office. And so the way I looked at it, after all the other security policemen were dead and out, that we were the next targets to be available. But at any rate, the auxiliaries were the team two, the B team, as it were. The legionnaires were Roman citizens, 6,000 to a legion. They had maintained 25 legions. So a legion would be 6,000 to 6,600, depending upon the particular instance. But around 6,000 to a legion, 25 legions in all, they're Roman citizens. The auxiliaries were recruited from conquered peoples and had the same total number as the legionnaires, but they were grouped in smaller segments. Instead of 6,000 to a group, they would be smaller segments, perhaps more easily managed that way, maybe not having as much trust with regard to arming such a big group of individuals who are not Roman citizens, those who are rather conquered peoples. But in any case, both of these groups are volunteers. And then we have another group that are the Praetorian Guard. We'll mention them more in just a moment. Now, the encouragement for someone to become an auxiliary soldier or become a part of the auxiliaries was to give them Roman citizenship after they served 25 years. Now, I don't know if that's a good deal or not. I mean, you got a kingdom going around the world and conquering this nation and that. I don't know if that's a good career choice or not. 25 years trying to dodge arrows and slings and spears and chariot wheels and all kinds of defensive measures regarding those peoples that you would attack. But after 25 years, they would be offered Roman citizenship. The Praetorian Guard, there were 9 cohorts of 1,000 men each recruited from the peninsula of Italy. So we have the auxiliaries there from any place in the conquered lands. We have the legionnaires there from any place in Italy and are Roman citizens. But now we're even more specific. We're limiting it more regarding the Praetorian Guard. They are from the peninsula. They're closer to Rome. They've got more of an investment, as it were, in Rome. And they were the bodyguards for the emperor. They're stationed at Rome. They served for 16 years. The legionaries served for 20 years before their retirement. Now, the Roman Empire also had a fleet, but it didn't have a very big navy because it didn't have very many good ports. And the ships of the day weren't very good for weathering bad weather or storms. Certain months of the year in the Mediterranean, the old time ships were not able to sail with any degree of certainty of arriving at their destinations. A case in point would be that of the shipwreck we have mentioned regarding the Apostle Paul as he was being taken prisoner over to Rome. But they were able to, nevertheless, to dispel piracy on the Mediterranean Sea, but they also controlled private shipping. Now, again, back to the shipwreck of the Apostle Paul, of which we have information in the book of Acts, that wasn't apparently a military ship. We have a cargo ship sailing, and it's sailing at the whim of it's carrying cargo. It's sailing at the whim of the time of the year that we can do that. And typically they would sail within sight of shore because of bad weather and the relative instability of those old wooden ships. But we see that they're carrying cargo, and they dispel the cargo, trying to keep the ship from floundering. And so the Roman soldier or soldiers that are with him and the prisoners of whom Paul was one, they're on a commercial ship. The commercial shipping also controlled by the Roman government. There are 2,000 miles of coastline for Italy, but they don't have very many harbors. And so couldn't make a lot of use of that. Then we have a census and taxation. That is how we open up the New Testament, looking at Joseph and Mary, and going back from Nazareth, where they were living, back to their ancestral home in Bethlehem, so they could be there to be adequately taxed, and then, or rather, a census, and after which would be a tax. So the census would be followed by taxation. Taxation would be used to pay for the military expansion of the Roman Empire. And so we have this census decree in the time of Augustus. We read about that in Luke chapter 2 and verse 1. In AD 14, a census numbered citizens in the Roman Empire at about 5 million people. Now that is deceptive. Why would that be deceptive? Why would we maybe not fully understand or comprehend what's going on? 5 million citizens in the Roman Empire at that particular time. What do you think? There's a difference between being a citizen and being a slave. A difference between being a citizen and being a conquered person. And so we have 5 million citizens, and this would be no more than half, if even that much, of the population under consideration. And then we have the succession from one emperor to another. Initially, the Praetorian Guard began choosing who would be the next emperor. And they would become emperor when the Senate would confirm the choice. When the Senate felt compelled to select the recommendation of the Praetorian Guard, because 9,000 folks with swords and shields saying, "This is the man." And the Senate not being able to adequately resist. And so the Praetorian Guard were the ones that were for a long time choosing the successive emperors. But then later the other armies throughout the Roman Empire said, "Well, why should they have all the fun? Why should they be the only ones who choose our political future? Why should they be the only ones who select the emperors?" And so the army starts selecting emperors, and they start selecting, this army would select this emperor, and this army would select this emperor, and only one, can only have one emperor, and so these Roman armies would fight each other relative to the selections that they had made, and the winner would be the emperor. So you can see there's a lot of upheaval in even inside the Roman Empire. When historians take a look at the fall of Rome, they don't initially attribute the fall of Rome to outside forces. And probably you've heard before that Rome fell from within. And this nation of ours may be the most powerful nation on the planet. And yet you and I can see that if we fall, it'll be from within, because our infrastructure, our morality, and so forth is under attack, has been for a long time, to some degree is crumbling from within. So Rome fell from within, had all kinds of turmoils going on. Life in Rome was similar in some respects to the life we have today. Carnivals and entertainment was the story of the day. They had 135 holidays annually. I don't know how many we have in America. I don't think we have 135 yet. 135, that's almost a third of the year, isn't it? Party time. I don't know how many holidays there are in India, but they have a lot of holidays in India too. All celebrated with big firecrackers that'll shake up the buildings and leave a lot of gunpowder in the air. So they have 135 days of holidays. They can amuse themselves with chariot races, gladiatorial combats. Fortunately, we've put that away, and we just use football and hockey and stuff like that instead of killing people for our amusement. And then I had theater also. The Roman Empire also provided an empire-wide currency, which also would contribute to the ease of travel. Many Jews migrated to Rome. They lived in their own section or neighborhoods, as did other peoples have their own neighborhoods as well, Greeks and Syrians. The Jews were allowed to practice their Jewish faith and culture without restriction. We mentioned last week that when the Roman Empire would conquer a country, those things that were already happening, particularly regarding religion, would automatically be grandfathered in. They would be legal. And so the Jews were conquered. They have a culture. They have a religion. And so that was absorbed into the Roman Empire. Not that the Romans were going to practice that, but they would tolerate it. And so the Jews were tolerated. They were able to migrate to Rome, have their own neighborhoods, as well as other groups of individuals going to their own neighborhoods and parts of metropolitan Rome. The Lord's Church was established, as we recall in Acts chapter 2. We have 15 different nationalities of Jews, those who have come from around the world back to Jerusalem for that particular Pentecost feast. We have enumerated 15 different nations from which those Jews came. In one of those nations, or one of those places from which the Jews came in that listing in Acts chapter 2, were from Rome. And so we don't have any specific breakdown in the 3,000 that were baptized as to how many were from this place and how many were from this place and how many were residents of Judea, how many were residents of Jerusalem, how many were residents of Galilee and so forth. We just know that among the perhaps 1 million or 2 million people that were there, but the residents plus those who came in for the feast, that 3,000 approximately obeyed the gospel of Christ, and that those who were there for the feast were from 15 different nationalities. Rome was included. We say that to indicate that there's a good possibility that some of the converts were from Rome. And so when they go back home, they take with them Christianity. As far as we can tell, Christianity predated in Rome, predated the arrival of any apostle. It's already going on. The church is already established before an apostle gets there. And so it appears as though that if not, as we suggested in Acts 2, at some other point in time, as somebody from Rome who had obeyed the gospel of Christ went back to Rome with the gospel of Christ. There was sharp arguments that arose between Jews and Jewish Christians in Rome. And therefore, Emperor Claudius told the Jews, you've got to get out of Rome. And this is documented in Acts chapter 18, verse 2. Well, when the Jews had to leave Rome, Christians also had to leave Rome. The first 10 years of the church, we have a completely Jewish church. We have those who were born Jews, as well as those who were Gentiles who had proselyted to Judaism, after which had obeyed the gospel of Christ. So we had a total Jewish church for the first 10 years. After we have the persecution occurring in Jerusalem, chapter 8, the church scatters. They take with them the gospel of Christ. And then we have the gospel of Christ being introduced to the Samaritans. And then later we have the gospel of Christ being introduced to Gentile populations as well. And so it was supposed to go from Jerusalem to Judea to Samaria and to the uttermost parts of the world, Acts chapter 1. It didn't happen, at least on any good timetable, but persecution was the catalyst or gave the sufficient ambition for Christians to go all over the world and take with them the gospel of Christ. And so we have Jewish Christians and Jews being expelled from Rome. If there were any Gentile Christians there too, they had to leave because the Roman Empire did not, at that time, make a distinction between Christianity and Judaism. We made mention last week that there were documented to be 24 different sects of Judaism. And in all likelihood, the Christianity was viewed as sect number 25, as far as the Romans were concerned. When the Romans understood that Christianity and Judaism were not the same thing, then Christianity became illegal. It wasn't a part of something that was grandfathered in through some conquest of some nation. Now, Christians ran into trouble, as well as did Jews, for that matter, because Christians refused to worship the state gods of Rome. And it's kind of interesting, they were viewed as atheists. Here they're worshiping the one true God of creation, the one true God of the universe, and they're viewed as atheists because they will not worship the idols that the Romans were worshiping. And then later when the emperors deemed themselves to be gods, and that the Christians and the Jews alike would not bow down to them, would not worship them, then they were traitors as well as atheists in the eyes of the Romans. And being viewed as traitors and being viewed as atheists, then the hardest and the severest type of persecution and often execution would come upon Jews and Christians who would not worship the idols and would not worship the emperor either. And Nero burned Rome in AD 64, and Christians were blamed for that. They were already a group that was poised to be hated. They were the ones that were always responsible for every bad thing that happened because they were the ones who would not conform to what was, as far as culture, society, and law was concerned, relative, for instance, to idolatry, wouldn't worship the emperor, that sort of thing. So Fox's Book of Martyrs reveals a number of hideous ways in which Christians suffered tormenting deaths because they would not recant, would not give up on Christ, would not turn their backs on God. As far as secular history is concerned, it appears as though Paul may have been the first apostle to arrive in Rome. Again, the city of Rome was populated by one half or more of slaves, and the rest were citizens. But being a citizen of Rome didn't necessarily mean that everything was good, everything was rosy, everything was all right. Because the Roman Empire lacked a middle class. You either had everything or you had nothing. You were either wealthy or you were impoverished. There wasn't any middle class to speak of. And there have been a number of nations around the world where you have an upper class or the top as far as finances are concerned, and then you've got abject poverty on the other side of the pendulum swing and nothing in the middle of any consequence. And so this was the case in Rome as well. And so most of the population was supported by welfare, by the public dole, you've got the 135 holidays, so you know work going on then, and then you've got widespread poverty, no middle class to speak of, a very limited amount of wealth at the very top of the apex of the population. And so the balance of the people are either on holiday or they're receiving a public dole. Again, contributing to the fall of Rome from the inside. some of the ways in which Christians were killed for their faith, wrapped in animal skins and killed by dogs, rubbed with clothes, wetted with flammable liquids and set on fire for light, crucifixion, and a lot of other ways that are very hideous. If you're interested in seeing some of the details, pick up Fox's Book of Martyrs for that. Now, martyred Christians, as well as perhaps Christians who would die naturally, were buried by fellow Christians in the catacombs underneath Rome. There are hundreds of miles of catacombs or tunnels dug underneath the city of Rome. And these were used for refuge, to hide from persecution, used for worship, and also used to bury Christian dead. And so these tunnels were from 8 to 10 feet tall, 4 to 6 feet wide. You may have seen some pictures of the interior of some of those tunnels, and maybe National Geographic or some such publication or some such documentary program on TV. Anybody, any question or comment or criticism before we go any further? I've been talking for a long time. Anybody, anything? Okay, just don't fall out of your seat now. Don't bang your head in the pew ahead of you. Don't fall asleep. Now, I find how Rome interjected itself into Palestine to be a very interesting scenario. It's not in these particular notes, but the Pharisees and Sadducees were at odds with each other for a long, long time. And it wasn't simply having a bad attitude or avoiding each other or saying bad things about each other, but they actually were involved about three generations before the opening of the first century in a civil war, the Sadducees and the Pharisees. And the Pharisees were on the losing end. And one of those climaxes of battles between the Pharisees and Sadducees, the Sadducees crucified 800 Pharisees on crosses and then gathered the families of the respective Pharisees being crucified on the crosses, assembled them at the foot of the respective crosses of the family member being crucified, and killed the family members in view of the Pharisee on the cross being crucified. So to say that the Pharisees and Sadducees didn't like each other is an understatement. They went to war with each other, and they were very unmerciful toward each other in warfare. Now, I can't remember which one did this, but one of the two groups, as they're having this civil war, says to Pompey, Roman general, "Would you please come over here and help us beat up on the other segment of Judaism?" He said, "I'll be happy to come in and beat up both sides." And in 63 BC, Rome took possession of Canaan or Palestine. It was taken away from them in conflict for a few years between 40 and 37 BC, and then Rome was able to take it back. And then we have the opening of the New Testament. We have Rome in control. And Rome stays in control. Rome also appoints Herod the Great to be king of the Jews. Herod was not a Jew. Herod was an Idumean. He was an Edomite. You remember when the Israelites in the wilderness wandering were, so within 1 year, came to the southern part of Palestine. Spies sent in, spies come back. Two spies say, "We can do it." The other say, "We can't do it." And the people are all upset. God says, "Okay, nobody's going in." And so 39 more years, they wander around until all of that generation, 20 years old and above, dies, except for Joshua and Caleb. Well, they couldn't, when it comes time to go into, finally go into the Canaan land, Edom's in the way. And God said, "You can't fight Edom. They're your cousins." You know, Esau, versus descending from Jacob, as the Jews were, the Edomites descended from Esau. So the Israelites go on the eastern side of the Dead Sea. They conquer the countries of Ammon and Moab and come up on the eastern side of the Jordan River, and they cross above Edom into Canaan land. Well, later in history, the Israelites did conquer Edom and made Edom in subjection to Israel. And so they had forced conversion. You become a Jew or you die. The choice was easy. And so they became Jews. But when you're forced to do something against your will, you don't have conviction, you don't have loyalty. And so here comes King Herod. He is an Edomite. He's Jewish in religion. He and his family and his people don't have a solid investment in Judaism. He's trying to please Rome and trying to some extent to please the Jewish people over whom he's ruling. He has an ancestral relationship to them. He also has a relationship to the Jews by way of the conquest of the Jews over Edom and the forced conversion. And so we see Herod the Great is not a very good practitioner of Judaism as the New Testament opens, though he's doing some, he's building the temple. He is trying to, along with others, of course, to resist the coming of the Messiah, the Christ, and so forth. So the first Roman emperor is Octavian Augustus Caesar. He was the emperor during the birth of our Lord, Luke 2:1. At the crucifixion of our Lord, we have Tiberius, who reigned AD 14 to 37. Then we have Caligula, 37 to 41, in part of the book of Acts. We have Claudius, AD 41 to 54, Nero, 54 to 68, contemporary with the life of the Apostle Paul. We have Trajan, contemporary with the Apostle John. And so regarding emperor, or regarding Herod, or regarding Pharaoh, these don't refer to specific individuals. They refer to dynasties. And you have to look a little bit more closely to figure out who's the individual or the person about whom we're talking beyond the dynasty. So simply referring to the Herod or referring to the emperor or referring to the Pharaoh doesn't give us the specifics of the individual about whom we're talking. You have to look more closely about that. In AD 66, we have the Zealots. We're going to have to close here. We have the Zealots that are they're the revolutionaries. They're the terrorists of their day. Among the Jews. And so there was a revolt that began in AD 66. Judea revolted against Roman rule, heavy taxation, murder of Jews in Caesarea, and retaliation, murder of a Roman garrison in Jerusalem by Jews, and a strong uprising of Jewish nationalism. And so Vespasian, the general, brings 50,000 troops to reconquer Judea. In the meantime, he's called to be emperor. Though the other emperor hadn't left office yet. And so his son Titus takes over the 50,000 troops and they conquer Jerusalem, they destroy it, destroy the temple as well. So that pretty much takes us through the balance of chapter 12. The time is gone. We have other classes that should be coming in momentarily. So we're going to forego the questions. We're going to forego chapter 13 dealing with the city of Corinth. And next week we plan to look at a PowerPoint presentation regarding Bible archaeology, and we'll find things that correspond to the biblical information that we can read in our Bibles, and we'll find corroboration of these very same things. We'll find that we have a valid reason for our hope in God, a valid reason for our hope in the Word of God as it has been preserved for us. I thank you for your very kind attention, not only tonight, but through the series of lessons. And so if you have any questions or comments or criticisms, please visit me after our devotional today in the foyer, and we can address that. Thank you very much.